The next case on the call of the docket this afternoon is agenda number 5, case number 127732, People of the State of Illinois versus Samuel Sauls. James Henry Waller.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is James Waller with the Office of the State Appellate Defender, and it's my pleasure to represent Samuel Sauls today. With the Court's indulgence, I intend to stand on the arguments in the briefs regarding the first issue, the sufficiency of the evidence argument, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about the second issue, the fact that the trial court erred when it granted the motion to quash the subpoena duces tecum without conducting the in-camera review of the requested documents. The question today is narrow and straightforward. The U.S. Supreme Court in Pennsylvania v. Ritchie established a procedure for in-camera review of these types of documents, which has been relied on and incorporated into Illinois law. That procedure does not require any heightened or particularized showing of materiality or relevance beyond what is already built into subpoena duces tecum law in Illinois. And regardless of what standard is used to evaluate such a showing, Sam Sauls, through trial counsel in this case, met that standard. The case should therefore be remanded back to the trial court to conduct that in-camera review of the documents, and if anything is in there that could have changed the outcome of the trial, a new trial should be ordered. Finally, even if this court takes the state's invitation to announce a new formulation of what that standard should be, the case should still be remanded back so that the parties can have an opportunity to argue about it and the court can evaluate it. Now, Pennsylvania v. Ritchie held that defendants in a criminal case have a due process right to potentially exculpatory evidence in the state's possession, but not an unbridled right of going through these statutorily protected documents. So in order to strike that balance, they came up with this procedure that says you have to subpoena these documents subject to the laws on subpoenas that already exist, and then if the subpoena is not quashed for those already built-in controls, then the trial court's supposed to conduct this in-camera review and only release information that is responsive and relevant to the parties. This court in People v. Bean ratified that holding. In that court, the defendant had subpoenaed the records. In that case, the trial court did the in-camera review and then held arguments on what information should be relevant and released, and this trial court called that the proper procedure. This procedure already works. The appellate courts have cited it approvingly. In the third district case discussed in the briefs, People v. Escarino, the defendant sought the exact same type of information, controlled by the exact same statute, and when the trial court quashed the subpoena, the third district remanded it for that in-camera review to take place. Mr. Sauls is asking for the exact same result to the exact same legal question.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't Ritchie say that a defendant cannot require the trial court to search through the file without first establishing a basis for the request?
Yes, Your Honor, that is what the footnote in Ritchie says. And that footnote kind of comes in three parts. So the footnote comes right after the central holding in Ritchie. The central holding says he's entitled to in-camera review. Then there's this footnote. The first part of the footnote says, the Commonwealth says that Ritchie's not entitled to disclosure because he didn't make a particularized showing of materiality, of what he's seeking or how it would be material. So after just having given its holding, they're entertaining and then dispensing with this argument from the state. They're saying that, that type of thing is contextually not necessarily. Then it moves into the second part of that footnote. Ritchie, of course, may not require the trial court to search through the file without establishing a basis for his claim that it contains material evidence. And it gives a C cite to Valenzuela Bernal,
well,
saying...
Well, counsel, are you skipping over that portion in the parentheses, the mere possibility that an item of undisclosed information might have helped the defense does not establish materiality?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't hear the first part of that.
Are you skipping over the portion of the language that's in parentheses after that sentence about would be material? Then in parentheses, don't they say the mere possibility that an item of undisclosed information might have helped the defense does not establish materiality in the constitutional sense?
Well, and you don't get to make just a vague assertion. That information
does it,
could have...
Does it say that in the decision as well?
It probably does. I'm sorry, I don't have that exact language in front of me. But yes, the defendant can't just make a vague assertion that there's information in there that could have helped me. He has to give a basis for why he believes that. In this case, the basis was there's possible prior inconsistent statements, and there's evidence of interest or bias between this witness and my client. And Just for completion's sake, though, the third part of that that footnote then goes on to say, although the obligation to disclose exculpatory material does not depend on the presence of the specific request, we note that the degree of specificity of his request may have a bearing on the trial court's assessment on remand. So the last section is saying that any lack in detail is really just going to hurt Richie because the court's not going to be able to give him the responsive information. But the basis in this case, the basis for materiality, which is all that he's required to demonstrate, is the same thing that's already controlled by subpoena ducis tecum law. In People v. Schakowsky, in language taken from U.S. v. Nixon, so the Rehnquist Court and Richie was fully aware of these subpoena requirements, the documents have to be evidentiary and relevant. The request has to be made in good faith, and it's not a fishing expedition. So you have to be able to give the basis. And the basis...
So what level of specificity is necessary?
Well, I think that not much more than just the theory of how this information could be useful. So in Valenzuela Bernal, they're saying there was two missing witnesses. It was a confrontation issue, a compulsory process issue. And they said, and the defendant didn't even give a reason as to why these two witnesses were necessary. In this case, it would not have been enough for Sauls to come in and say, I want to see that information. I think it might be helpful. He has to come in and say it has prior inconsistent statement and it shows the interest in bias. And it's particularly, that basis is good enough, particularly in this case, where this witness, the credibility of this witness is important not only to the jury's determination of what happened, but even as a gatekeeper for inadmissible evidence under 11510, the court has to be able to decide whether or not the content and credibility of the witness are such that they can allow the evidence in. I believe that it was far lower. I believe, Your Honor, that the representations made in this case were more specific and direct. I believe that in Richie, they were just alleging the possibility of the names of witnesses, of potential witnesses.
But it doesn't mention the names in this case.
I'm sorry?
It doesn't mention the names in this case.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the witness is known, and it has to do with the credibility of this particular witness and prior inconsistent statements this witness made and evidence of bias and interest that this witness has. And it's particularly problematic in this case where there's a demonstrated history of conflict between this witness and the defendant that reached a boiling point kind of right before some of these disclosures were made. So the context of this case, and this is always going to be a fact-dependent investigation, but the context of that representation made it sufficient in this particular case. We can see that it's still a workable test, that you have to enunciate the basis and explain why you need these things. If we imagine if Officer Smith's only ties to an investigation was that she drove a purported controlled substance to the state police crime lab in Morton. There's no allegation that she coerced a confession or had any interaction with the defendant. Defense counsel subpoenas her disciplinary records and excessive force complaints. There's no basis for that. There's no relevant basis for that. Defense counsel can't come in with any theory that would make that relevant, and the court would not be in error to refuse to do an in-camera review in that circumstance. But they could make the exact same request of the exact same type of protected information for Officer Thompson, who elicited a confession about intent to distribute that same controlled substance. So it's always going to be contextually significant, not only what basis is elucidated, is spoken by defense counsel, and what the evidence is in relation to this case.
Do you agree with the standard that was set forth in Valenzuela Bernal, that is the proponent must make some plausible showing of how the evidence would have been both material and favorable to his defense?
Well, I think that would be a good first step. I mean, if that was the holding in Richie, and I don't think that it tracks directly through. I don't think that the Richie court is saying, because of what happened in Valenzuela Bernal, this is the exact same situation. Richie is saying that just like in Valenzuela Bernal, you have to give some reason as to why this evidence is important, and that's all that it asks for. I don't think that the Rehnquist Court in Ritchie is going to be introducing a limitation on the right that it just announced in a footnote by a C-cite to a case that was involving another constitutional principle.
Would you agree that the setting of the standard, and whatever the standard is a question of law, but then when we apply that standard to any situation, including this one, it would be an abuse of discretion?
Yes, I think it would be an abuse of discretion. That certainly makes sense. It would be because it would rely on the particular facts and factors of the case. I don't think abuse of discretion is the appropriate standard here because none of the parties believed that they were arguing towards that type of specific of a standard. Again, the showing that was made in this case was superior to the showing that was made in Ritchie. So Ritchie's not discussed at the trial court, of course, in this case, but we have to assume that they were making the arguments towards the law as it was understood at that time.
And the showing here, you said it's greater than Ritchie here.
It is.
But it's much less than Escanara here, correct? I mean, Escanara involved the defendant and the victim.
Right, right. Well, in this case, it involves the complaining witness and possibly the same victim. We don't know.
It doesn't involve the defendant at all as far as we know.
That's correct.
So it involves the victim's mother.
Right, that's correct. And it may involve the victim. We don't know who the possible victim is. If the court had done the in-camera review and announced why it was granting or not granting the request, maybe we would have that information. And that's why... I mean, Ritchie spoke to the impossibility of upsetting too high of a standard for something like this. If the parties don't know, I mean, again, the timing of this, the unfounded reports were from fall of 2018, which was right in the middle of contemporaneous of this investigation. So I think that the allegations of the abuse may have happened sometime in 2017. Some of the disclosures happened over 2018, and it's going to trial through 2019. In the middle of that, there's an investigation, possibly regarding the same victim, involving the state's chief witness. Chief witness not only for occurrence issues, but the gatekeeper of that 11510 evidence. So that's enough to get in-camera review. There's enough of a nexus to the relevant facts that the court needs to consider in order to get in-camera review, at least in this case.
All about credibility of witnesses, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
This case is all about credibility of witnesses.
That's right.
And so the fact finder heard all the evidence and decided one way. You're saying certain witnesses should not have been allowed to testify or should have been allowed?
Well, it's possible that there's evidence in those reports that that may have been admissible, or at least led to admissible material. So we're talking about a discoverability standard, not admissibility. But it's possible that those reports contained information that defense counsel could have used to impeach those witnesses or could have affected the court's determination of her credibility for allowing in her representation of what those 11510 disclosures could have been. So it would have been important for the court or possibly the jury to hear, depending on what the contents were and what the theory were.
We don't know anything. Correct.
That's right. And I think that's why Ritchie cautions against setting too high of a bar. It talks about how it's impossible to know. Both sides are working in the dark, and we can't expect anybody to come in as Carnac the Magnificent and guess what's in these reports. Even Johnny Carson opened the envelope and did his on-camera review to find out what's in there, and that's all that we're asking for in this case. The court wouldn't even be able to, even if he comes in, if Saul, as a trial counsel, comes in and makes a very detailed representation, it doesn't do a lot of good because the court can't evaluate how likely that is to be true until it does the in-camera review. So even in this case, the prosecutor says, well, we don't think that there's any Brady material in there, but we haven't looked at it. Okay, then that representation is not very good. So whether the defense counsel comes in and says, we're certain that it's in there, and the state comes in and says, we're certain that it's not, setting a standard that high doesn't help anybody, doesn't help uncover the truth, because we need to have in-camera review of those documents. It's just like
so in
anything.
In every case where the Department of Children and Family Services is involved, the defense should be allowed to get every statement they have taken, right?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. Again, it's going to be contextually dependent, just like the disciplinary records that police officer were. In this case, where the reports happened contemporaneous, possibly with at least either the abuse or any reporting of the abuse, if either happened, and it involved possibly the same child, and it certainly involved the state's chief witness, I think that's a basis for how the evidence may be material.
So how would you phrase the rule?
Well, I think that Ritchie phrased the rule. I think the Rehnquist court phrased the rule just fine. You have to demonstrate a basis for relevance. The basis for relevance was potential exculpatory information, inconsistent statements, and a demonstrated history of bias between these two witnesses. So I don't think any formulation, any change to the law needs to be made, and the state hasn't made any good argument as to why Bean is not workable. With that in mind, Mr. Sauls asked that the case remand this court remand the case so that the in-camera review can be conducted. And even if, again, as I said, if the court does announce a new standard for this type of thing or clarifies the standard, the case should still be remanded back so that the parties can speak to that standard and the trial court can make an evaluation based on this court's decision. So if there's no other questions, I'll see you back in a moment.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Waller. Mr. Mitchell Ness.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Assistant Attorney General Mitchell Ness on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois.
Could you speak up, please?
Yeah, sorry. I'll try and raise this too. Like defendant, I'll rest on my briefing regarding the sufficiency argument and go right into due process. As I understood appellant's argument today, he largely agrees with the state that some showing needs to be made before records can be reviewed in camera by a trial court. If that's the case, then the state and the defendant largely don't disagree about anything. What the state disagreed with and where I think the original briefing started was the Third District's opinion in Escareno, which concluded essentially that Ritchie did not require that showing before an in-camera review should be conducted, but instead Escareno ruled that any time a subpoena goes out for privileged documents, an in-camera review is automatic. That's what the people would push back on and disagree with. And I believe that reading of Ritchie, Ritchie's, footnote 15 makes sense and has been adopted by an overwhelming amount of state and federal courts to read it. And it's clear language. It says that a defendant cannot require a trial court to conduct an in-camera review of a privileged document without first showing some basis of materiality. And as this court alluded to, the Ritchie standard, or at least one that was contemplated in Ritchie, was this plausible showing standard. And I believe that is a completely workable standard, although somewhat vague. Courts deal with those kinds of standards all the time. That's a case-by-case determination based on the facts, based on the arguments before it.
Counsel, in this case, though, there's allegations of bias and dealing with the other parents or step-parents. So isn't that enough?
So that would be sort of the second part of this. The first part is, whether Ritchie and footnote 15 allow the trial court to withhold the in-camera review until the showing is made. Your question is kind of aimed at the second issue, which is, was that showing made here? I personally don't think so. I think the trial court was correct in finding that showing had not been made. I would point the court towards this court's previous decision in Foggy, in which it dealt with privileged communications made to a rape crisis counselor. And left the actual language back there, but the Foggy court ends up saying, so the argument made below at the trial court was that, I think that the victim may have made some contradictory statements to the rape crisis counselor, and I'd like the court to conduct an in-camera review to determine if that's the case. And this court very clearly said the vague assertion that the victim may have made statements to her therapist that might possibly differ from the victim's trial testimony does not provide a sufficient basis to justify ignoring the trial court's order. So there's clearly something more that you need to do than just use some Brady-related buzzwords. You can't just say bias. You can't just say contradictory statements. You need to tie them to the case and tie them to why you believe what's in that record meets that standard. So there's sort of the Ritchie, you know, if we call it the Ritchie standard, there's two aspects to it. There's one, it has to be a plausible showing, which is, you know, sort of a very low-level belief that this record exists and what you think is in the record exists. But the second part is that you have to make a plausible showing that the information is actually material to your defense, not just, as defendant alluded to, relevant. The standard is actually materiality, which is, you know, under break.
How low is the low level?
The courts that have applied Ritchie to require a preliminary showing of materiality before have grappled with that. They've certainly understood it to be a lower standard, and they've taken into account the fact that this is all pretrial. This is without a defendant's, most of the time without a defendant's knowledge of what's in a record. So it is very case by case. I suppose, you know, without trying to get into too many hypotheticals about what happened in this case, I think it'd be helpful to think a little bit about what, you know, the words used here and maybe what could have changed the outcome below. You know, he says the defendant's counsel below argued that, you know, there was interest in bias on behalf of the mother, but doesn't connect to bias against defendant. Why would there have been bias against defendant in those records? Doesn't say why they think that there's potentially bias in those records. And I think all those, you need to connect the dots. You need to be able to say, you know, I believe that because, let's say, you know, for instance, let's say that the defendant had filed that report against the victim's mother, and that's why they believe there was bias. And, you know, the mother was trying to retaliate against the defendant for making a false report against her or something. You know, you need to say that stuff. You need to say, you know, you have to give your plausible explanation of why you think what's in there is in there. I don't think you need to make, you know, the courts have rejected the words, you don't have to make a particularized showing, because that would be a little too much, and you just don't know what's going to be in the record. But
do you agree that this is an abuse of discretion standard that we're looking at here as to whether or not that level has been met?
Right. Answering the second question of whether the argument below met that standard, I believe that would be an abuse of discretion standard.
Did the trial court, in fact, abuse its discretion here by not exercising its discretion?
No, I do not believe so.
Didn't the trial court here say that under the Act, these reports are confidential, and I don't see any basis to release them based on impeachment?
The trial court certainly did not call this a Ritchie hearing. But I don't believe that's not what occurred. You know, we presume that the trial courts understand and apply the law. Ritchie has been established law since.
Well, we presume that most of the record shows all this. So my question to you is based on this record.
Right.
Show me where the trial court exercised its discretion.
Right. Well, I would point to two things in the preliminary background leading to this hearing leading to the motion to quash hearing. Originally, the defendant filed sought these records and filed a Rule 412H motion, which is a, as this court is well aware, is a discretionary disclosure, additional discovery tool that a defendant can use. And a Rule 412H discretionary disclosure can be granted upon a showing of materiality to the preparation of the defense. So that's where this sort of started, was this idea that I think I need that because it's important to my defense. It turned into, you know, the state, the county attorney said, well, we're not able to get these records, so you need to subpoena them. So then we go through the subpoena process. We end up with this subpoena duces tecum and a motion to quash the subpoena. And it is true that the state relied on confidentiality, but as indicated in the record, the defendant was well aware that it needed to make a relevance argument, and they attempted to do so. They just didn't sufficiently do so. And so the trial court did not say on the record, I do not find that these are relevant, or I do not find that you've made a plausible showing of materiality, but I believe that that's what occurred, and I believe everybody knew that that's what was occurring, particularly considering the fact that this has been an established procedure for quite some time. I guess I'll just say one thing.
Except for the idea about confidentiality, what other factors did the trial judge consider when saying he's not giving them that information?
Well, it considered the argument made before it, which was, you know, admittedly a short argument, as often as you all are aware that these records could be. But it considered the argument before it, and the defendant made this argument for materiality. They made the argument for why they needed this document. The court heard that argument and decided, you know, you do not need the document. And it, yes, relied on, in some ways, relied on confidentiality of the report. But that's also part of this test. The other half, you know, we're trying to weigh due process interest against a state's right to keep something confidential. And so, you know, that's a relevant portion of this test, is that this statute actually is attempting to keep these things confidential. You've not made a sufficient showing to overcome that confidentiality. And so I do not find the trial court did not find that it needed to conduct the in-camera review.
So the analysis, you combine the confidentiality statement and an assumption.
I think this court really dives into Ritchie. If this court reads Foggy, I think that's actually what happened in Foggy. There's this unanswered question in Ritchie about whether a statute that prescribes an absolute bar to the dissemination of records can overcome a defendant's due process right to material information. And the Ritchie court explicitly said that it's not answering that question, that it was only answering the question before it, which was a statute with more exceptions to confidentiality. The Foggy court, a year later, kind of grappled with what that meant, what Ritchie was trying to say, in that the Ritchie court, the Foggy court said, look, Ritchie considered this statute with several exceptions to confidentiality. We're considering a statute with almost no exceptions to confidentiality. But it didn't end there. It didn't just say, well, because that statute is fully confidential, no in-camera review would ever be granted. Instead, it went through a detailed analysis of what the Foggy defendant, what the argument that the Foggy defendant made to the trial court was, and it repeatedly said, the defendant made a vague assertion. The defendant didn't connect its case to why it believed that this rape crisis counselor testimony was material to it, and it repeatedly said that considering the legislature's clear indication, the essentially extra indication that rape crisis counseling victims deserve confidentiality in their records, combined with the defendant's lack of any plausible showing that the records were necessary, that the privilege was not required to be breached in that case. So I think that is certainly an interesting question for the application of this rule going forward, as to what happens when a statute is more explicitly confidential than the one we have here. And, following the Foggy Court's sort of discussion of this, I think it does play into the actual due process requirement, or the trial court's assessment of what due process requires. Yeah.
Counsel, this is just an aside. What do you think caused the trial court's change of heart? Because after all, when the records initially weren't disclosed, the trial court said, fine, we'll do a subpoena duplicitum. And then there was no objection to that, and there didn't seem to be any objection to the trial court reviewing them in camera. So what?
I would disagree with the last portion, that there was no objection to the trial court reviewing them in camera. The state essentially acted here as a third party. You had the county attorney was the prosecuting authority. The state came in and argued the motion to quash. It's a third party. DCFS is a third party. So what the state ultimately said is that, you should quash this because of our privilege. If you're not going to,
right,
then we can do an in-camera review.
Right.
Which is exactly what the procedure that I would advocate for here, that if a motion to quash is not granted because the plausible showing was made, then we go to in-camera review. And then the trial court conducts the in-camera review, determines what's material to a case, and then disseminates what it believes is material.
So you're of the opinion that the trial court ultimately concluded that the necessary showing had not been made and thus declined to do the in-camera review?
Correct, yeah. I forgot the... Right. I think that's a lot of points. If there's no other questions... I would ask that the court uphold the decision at the appellate court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ness.
Good
Mr. Waller?
Thank you. And I apologize, Ms. Justice Holder-White. I see the section you were talking about as far as the parenthetical. They did say the mere possibility that an item of undisclosed information might have helped the defense does not establish materiality. That's correct. I would add on to that the fact that in this case we had more than just a vague assertion that the undisclosed information might have helped the defense. They
Counsel,
gave.
Refresh my memory on the showing that your client made. I mean, the representations your client made as to what this evidence would show.
Trial counsel just said that it would demonstrate interest and bias of the witness and might contain inconsistent statements, prior inconsistent statements.
And it might.
That's correct, which I think is all that's contemplated by Ritchie. Again, everybody understands that they're going to be negotiating and advocating in the dark here. So it's not just a vague assertion that the information might be helpful, but they gave grounds as to why it's believed to be helpful. And again, the context matters, because everybody knew this was going to be a 115-10 case. Everybody knew that her credibility was going to be determinative on the lion's share of the state's evidence coming in on this case. So what might be a vague assertion in one case might not be a vague assertion in another case. In this case, it was contextually relevant, and everybody involved in that court that day knew why prior inconsistent statements and the credibility of this witness, particularly any bias against Mr. Sauls, was going to be material, was certainly going to be relevant. And I agree with the question earlier about regarding the abuse of discretion. The court did abdicate any discretion in this case. I believe that what the trial court, what Judge DeFana said was that I believe the department is correct about these records being confidential. That was the end of the analysis. It was not part of this two-part Ritchie analysis. Is it confidential, and now what are your interests to compete against that? They said, well, and again, the department, the only objection they made was that this is privileged information, that this is confidential information. They didn't come in and object under any of the conditions that control subpoenas DCS tecum, that this was not relevant, not material, couldn't lead to discoverable evidence, was overly burdensome. All these policy arguments weren't made, simply that the information was confidential. So the court gave no discretion here. I think that the Foggy court, to jump to Mr. Ness's comments regarding Foggy, it wasn't just that, I agree, it wasn't just entirely that, this court did say that the records in Foggy are not part of Ritchie analysis. Because there's an absolute bar for these type of records, we don't even have to worry about the language in Foggy. But they also said that the defendant did not even allege the existence of discoverable evidence. And that ended up being a controlling issue here. Here, I think, they clearly did allege the existence of material evidence. So we are beyond a vague assertion. We are beyond a vague assertion that undisclosed information might help the defense or that it might be helpful. He gave the bases for his belief that the information would be material and relevant. That's all that's required by Ritchie. So with that in mind, we ask the court to remand the case for the performance of the in-camera review. And again,
let me ask one final question.
Please, Your Honor.
In the exercise of discretion, the evidence is admitted by a trial court.
Right.
What would you require a trial court to say or do to show that the trial court exercised their discretion?
Well, some recognition that Ritchie was a controlling case and that it was analyzing the question under the rubric of Ritchie would demonstrate that discretion had been exercised. It's always going to be a case-by-case determination. There are certain things where we assume that the court has balanced certain evidence in aggravation, mitigation, even though they don't have to announce every single thing. There are some assumptions. In a case like this, the court came out and said, I believe the department has the better of this, in that the records are confidential, so I'm granting the motion to quash. The court announced explicitly that they didn't exercise their discretion, at least under the appropriate rubric. So, otherwise, I hesitate to give an overwhelming 10,000-foot view of what the evidence of an exercise of discretion would be, because it's going to be case-specific. But all I can tell you is it didn't happen in this case. Is there any follow-up? Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Case number 127732, People of the State of Illinois versus Samuel Sauls, will be taken under advisement as agenda number 5. I want to thank you, Mr. Waller and Mr. Ness, for your arguments this afternoon.